The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is the James Gray Show with the Lords Taverners.
You're listening to a podcast edition of the James Gray Show. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1:30 p.m. on Love Sport Radio on DAB Digital, online, or on your Alexa smart speaker. And if you're listening to the podcast, do leave us a rating and a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Love Sport.
You know what? Sometimes I make mistakes, right? And I'll hold my hands up and admit that sometimes I get things wrong. On this occasion, I spent some time this morning writing about Dave Warner's kind of weird struggles. Because although before today he was averaging 75, his strike rate this year for Australia was only 77. So he'd been scoring runs, but not at the kind of rate we're used to. As a career, I think his strike rate in ODIs was 95, which would suggest that he was performing at a suboptimal level. Now, there was 100 against Pakistan, which is close to a run a ball. But he also played some painful innings this year. You know, that 56 against India, for example, it was his slowest ever half century in ODI cricket. So it kind of begs the question, and although he has answered it a little bit today, why pick him at all? Because Australia, I think, are playing a brand of cricket that won the World Cup 4 years ago. That's the sort of cricket they're playing. I don't think they're playing this kind of cricket that England are now playing, which is where 350, 370 is par. And at Trent Bridge, frankly, 350 is kind of par. So I think they need to realise, a bit like when Germany got to the World Cup semi-final in 2002, they need to realise that while David Warner is scoring a lot of runs, another boundary he's hit there, it's a little bit of a false economy. Because I don't know if he's going to come in into a game against New Zealand or India or England and score 100 off 90 balls, which is what you need. And I just question whether Australia are going down the right road. Australian cricket writer Paul Dennett was on Nick Compton's Cricket World Cup show this morning, and he posited an interesting theory.
I don't think there's any chance that they'll drop him, no. And I think that part of the reason that he's playing in this, and I agree, it's a perplexing, conservative way, I can only assume that it's with the blessing of team management, that they're saying, this is a tournament where you need to build a platform, we can accelerate away at the end. We don't want you playing a rash shot and getting out early. But as an Australian fan, I think he's gone too conservatively. I'd prefer to see the Warner of old, and if he gets out early on in a few games, so be it.
My commentator's curse is in such good nick at the moment. David Warner's out. Literally, as I was talking about how well he's been playing, he's just lifted the ball to short third man. He's gone for 162. A terrific innings, but not the first time. Trent Bolt yesterday, I was talking about how well New Zealand had been fielding, and he promptly dropped the catch that second. I did it last night as well, you know. I sent a jokey tweet when England were 1-0 up but struggling against Japan. And I said, good to see that England's devotion to failing to close out World Cup games extends across the gender divide. And literally 20 seconds later, England scored their second goal. So, my commentator's curse in good nick. Dave Warner is also in good nick, sort of. 166 of 147 balls, he is gone now. But when they play the top sides, I don't think Warner's going to do that. I think when he's played a top side this year, he's struggled to score quickly, barring that 100 against Pakistan. So when you've got Khawaja in the order as well, another accumulator, I don't really understand it. Why? And, you know, Paul suggested there that maybe the Australian management are telling Warner to play like this. But why would you do that? Why would you do that when you've got one of the most destructive men in world cricket? We've seen that in 20 over and 50 over. Warner's a beast. He's an animal when it comes to hitting the ball hard. Why would you not go out there and give him license to do it and make Khawaja the man you all bat around? Then Australia will be really dangerous. I really do think that. South Africa, meanwhile, are not dangerous. They, of course, went out of the Cricket World Cup yesterday, just 3 weeks after they started it. Their one win so far came against Afghanistan. They chased down 121. It wasn't exactly a hard work for them. They're a mess. They're an absolute mess. They're standing still in world cricket while everyone else is moving forward. You can perhaps best tell what the problem with the South Africa team is when you look at this lineup. Let me read this lineup out, right? De Kock, Amla, Du Plessis, Rousseau, Dumini, Miller, Pretorius, Felekweu, Steyn, Rabada, Tahir. That team was the side that chased down 372 in Durban 3 years ago. Now, you might say, what? But they're all... Exactly. That team, seven of them played yesterday when they were beaten by New Zealand. It would have been eight were Dale Steyn not injured, and Dumini and Pretorius are both in the squad. The only man who's not part of the team anymore is Riley Rousseau, and he's playing in England on a Colpack deal. And, of course, that is part of the problem as well. People are leaving South African cricket because it's more lucrative to play domestic cricket elsewhere in the world. The problems are so many different faceted. You've got the quota issues, you've got financial issues, you've got political issues. To the extent that AB de Villiers rang up, and this is a man, the most high-profile man, who refuses to play for South Africa. He rang them up the night before the World Cup, and he said, do you want me to come and play? Because, you know, I'm still, if you need me, I'll come. And they as a selection group, went, oh, no. They probably wanted him, because he's such a good player. But that's the depths that South African cricket's come to. They had to turn down their best player on the eve of a World Cup. They didn't even have the option of selecting him until 12 hours before the squad. It's crazy that AB de Villiers isn't at this World Cup. And South Africa are the first side to be... Or maybe the second side to be eliminated. I suppose Afghanistan already out as well. They've played poorly. I looked at their team, you know, and when they have Steyn fit... They are a good side. When you've got Ngidi, Rabada, Steyn, Tahir, and then, you know, 10 overs from the likes of Felekweu or maybe a bit of Pretorius or whatever. Yeah, that's a decent side. A good top order, De Kock, Amla, Faf du Plessis on his day. But they've not performed and they haven't progressed. South Africa are in deep, deep trouble. And I really hope in 4 years' time when the next World Cup comes around, they'll find a way to get out of it.
Love sport.
I want to talk about Jesse Lingard, who won't have to sing for his safety, but he might have to sing for his supper. If you follow Jesse Lingard on Snapchat, I bet Aaron follows Jesse Lingard on Snapchat. It's just his sort of app. Or, in fact, even if you know what Snapchat is, or, frankly, if you didn't, you might still have seen this video from his holiday. He was walking around his hotel suite, clearly about to leave, end of his holiday, clearly been a great trip, you know. And we've all been on these boys' holidays, you know, in your 20s. Frankly, girls' holidays, it's not a gender-specific thing. You go on a trip with your mates to a nice, sunny, foreign place, and you have a good old laugh. And that's exactly what Lingard had clearly been doing. I think we've got a little bit of the audio from the video. Have a little listen.
Bye. Bye, room. It's been emotional. Seen a lot of good memories in this room. Now to the next room. Mr. Mark, you see, that's his room. Seen a lot of sleeping, don't forget. Been a lot of sleeping in this room.
No, there's not.
There's been a lot of sleeping. Oh, look at the views, man. Views, man. Right, Rash. I'll give this a 3 out of 5 room. Jesse Lingard. No, 4 out of 5 room. 4 out of 5 room. Now, onto Jamal Bankash. This room. I give this room a minus 14 out of 10.
Jesse Lingard messing around with his mates and videoing it. Because it's 2019 and everyone under the age of 30 videos almost everything they do. But I sometimes forget to video when I go to the toilet, but I know that you're supposed to. Sort of the idea, isn't it? Now, look, it's obviously moronic. It's pretty silly. This is the same man, the same creative genius who gave us such hits as Beans, Beans, Beans. Now, I wasn't fully aware of the Beans, Beans, Beans video, but my producer Ben alerted me to it.
Beans, beans, beans.
Beans, beans, beans.
I said, what? Say, bean, bean, bean. 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 Bean, bean, bean.
Beans, beans, beans. It's kind of a banger. Why did he get so much abuse about this? It's a banger. Now, look, on a serious note, it is silly. And they're messing around like young guys. And the only reason I saw either of those videos was because social media went mad with it. Absolutely mad with it. You know, what is actually wrong? Forget the beans video. That's obviously insane. But, you know, the video of Lingard going around his mate's room saying, yeah, you've been rubbish this holiday, you silly sausage. All right, it's a bit of swearing. And yeah, Lingard's accent is aggressively Mancunian. Let's not move away from that. But that's unpleasant if it's not illegal. And I'm not a Jesse Lingard fan, ordinarily, in really any way. I think he loves himself a bit too much. He's a bit too focused on his own personal brand and probably not focused enough on trying to improve his performances on the pitch. But in this case, he's getting a lot of stick very unfairly. I had the displeasure of listening to Alan Brazil and Ali McCoist on TalkSport Breakfast lay into Jesse Lingard for having the temerity to go on holiday, have a good time, and post a video of his mates messing around in a hotel suite. Ali McCoist claiming he'd had as good a time as anyone while playing football, if not better. But he didn't talk about it, so it didn't matter. Alan Brazil called it shocking. Disgraceful. I mean, honestly, this is hand-wringing about a bloke on holiday winding up his mates. And it didn't stop at TalkSport's breakfast show. It went on. Tom McDermott on Twitter: why Lingard feels the need to do this is beyond me. Of course he's entitled to a holiday, but he's at one of the biggest clubs in the world. Doesn't help him at all, IMO. What? So you're saying that everyone who works for Deloitte isn't allowed to go on holiday and have a bit of a laugh? Everyone who works for Deloitte has to act in a professional way at all times just because they've got a big social following. Maurice Kilbridge clearly feels the need to compensate for his lack of talent. Just embarrassing to himself and as a club ambassador for Manchester United, posting such a juvenile and cringeworthy video as that. What? He's not a club ambassador. He's a player for a start. He's kind of entitled to do what he wants. He's not walking around in a Manchester United tracksuit. He doesn't represent Manchester United every second of every day. What do you actually want Jesse Lingard to do? Every time he goes to the toilet, he has to do it in a really professional way, a really grown-up way, because, you know, he's a Manchester United. You're representing Manchester United, mate. You can't just go like that. You can't pee in a bush on a golf course. Honestly, why are Manchester United players subjected to this sort of higher standard than anyone else? It's not a club. It's not the church. I don't know why this club has such a higher standard. Phil Standish: this is highly irresponsible. I'd expect some kind of official reprimand from Manchester United for Jesse Lingard. Tell me what he's done wrong. Ring us on 0208 70 20 558 and tell me what Jesse Lingard has done wrong. Honestly, I don't understand what you think he has done. There's a bit of swearing. He drops the F word a few times. And the S word. But there's nothing sexist. There's nothing racist. He's not doing a Nazi salute in an Instagram post. He's not abusing a Thai stripper. All he's done is taken a video of his mates, one of whom happens to be making a lewd gesture with a pillow. I mean, come on. Where are we living if you're not allowed to do that? What world are you living in if you're not allowed to go on holiday and mess around with your mates? Honestly, if it was the in-betweeners, you'd laugh at them. They're not even as funny as the in-betweeners, quite frankly. But Chris Stiff on Twitter: not the right mentality for a big or any professional football club. It's getting beyond a joke. Yeah, do as you please, but to film it and post it is not good. By the way, half the reason Jesse Lingard is a successful footballer is because he films and posts everything he does. That's the whole point. He is a powerful social media brand. Now look. Oh, here's a good one from Gavin McCallum on Twitter. Others are putting their Insta story videos of them training on holiday, keeping fitness up. Players at clubs like Burnley and Borough. Some work hard, others post rubbish like this. Really? Look, if Lingard comes back 2 stone overweight and takes 3 months to get match fit, yeah, I will tear into him. Quite happily tear into him. And we should. And maybe we can look at this video and go, Jesse, was this really what you were getting up to over the summer? Is that really what you should have been doing? But he hasn't yet. So let's give him a chance. If he comes back fully refreshed, like he's had a good time, then surely we can just say, yeah, you know what, Jesse, do what you want in the end. He's 26 years old. He's a young lad. Now, in football, sometimes we forget that 26 is still young because they've been playing for United for 8 years. And we think, oh, but, you know, he's 26, he should be peaking. 26 is nothing. Have you met a 26-year-old lately? They're morons. All of them are. And Lingard is no different. Frankly, he's a bit more mature than most 26-year-olds I know, even if he does have a weird dress sense and a weird sense of humour. In the grand scheme of things, he's just a young lad. And you know what? Fans aren't angry at Jesse Lingard. They're angry at the club. They're angry at the club because Jesse Lingard is their future. And actually, I think he's a bit of a mediocre player. I don't think he's fabulous. And that's what they're angry at. They're angry at the fact that the world's changing and they don't understand young people anymore. And they think that just because you're a footballer, you shouldn't be allowed to pass funny videos on Instagram or Snapchat or whatever social media channel you want to use. Because I'm sure in the last 10 minutes that three have been invented that people are still using. All these fans are angry at the club. The TalkSport Breakfast Show are just angry at the world because they think it's moved past them, which it has. They all remember what Manchester United was like under Sir Alex Ferguson, and they don't think it was Lingardian.
Love Sport.
You may have seen the story the other day that Paul Scholes was fined £8,000 for breaking FA betting rules after placing 140 bets on football matches between August 2015 and January 2019. Now, we've got someone on the line who, well, I suppose is an expert of sorts on this sort of topic, Chris Murphy. He's a darts commentator for PDC, but also a recovering gambling addict. Chris, why don't you tell us a little bit about your story when it comes to gambling? From having worked with people, you know, who've been through this as well, it tends to start at young age. Was it the same with you?
Yeah, very similar. So I used to, like a lot of lads around 16, 17, started playing football with the men's team just in my local village, and everyone would go and place like accumulator bets before the 3 o'clock kickoffs before we played football, and then we'd get back to the clubhouse to watch the results come in. And how it started for me was my first ever bet, which I was underage to place anyway, it was a £2 bet that won 350 quid, and that's how it all started, really.
And then as time went on, it presumably became a problem. At what point did you realise, or what was the wake-up moment when you thought, actually, this is a problem and I need to deal with it?
So, yeah, I think it's important to recognise gambling addiction like any other addiction, such as drugs and alcohol, in the fact that the addict very often is the last person to realise or be willing to admit that they've got a problem. And I certainly followed that path and really went at it quite hard for about 5 years. And at the point for where for most of that time I was gambling every day, I ended up getting thrown out of college for non-attendance, lost jobs, relationships, friends, all sorts of things. And unfortunately, well, fortunately now for me, but unfortunately at the time, the sort of real point of crisis was a suicide attempt when I was 23.
And tell me, I mean, it's obviously a harrowing story. What was your path to recovery? What you say you were the last person to know. At what point were you able to say it's gambling that's led me down this path?
I think, the sort of obvious point was on the day that I sort of attempted to take my own life, it basically felt like a decision between like winning everything back that I'd lost.
Yeah.
Or just ending my own life, which is the ultimate gamble, I suppose. And I think because other people had pointed out to me in the past, and I kind of just had to admit defeat, although it's not been a serene passage to recovery since, and I've been in some form of recovery ever since, but I've had several relapses. And I guess some of the stuff that we'll come on to talk about will sort of cover perhaps why those relapses happened more easily than they perhaps could have.
Well, I suppose you work in, you know, you're a darts commentator with the PDC, and, you know, I've worked in sport long enough to know that the sport and gambling industries are inextricably linked. I suppose for someone like you, the opportunities are everywhere, aren't they?
Yeah, it's quite interesting, actually, for me, because I then, after that, decided to go to university as a mature student and trained in sports journalism, got a good degree and went on to become a commentator and stuff, doing all the things that I wanted to do before gambling took hold of my life. And my sort of vision was very much, if this is a thing that's destroying, has destroyed my life up to now, I don't want it to be the thing that destroys the dreams that I've held. Mm. Which has obviously put me in a position where I do work in sport, which is heavily linked to gambling. But I think that the discussion needs to be a little bit more sensible in terms of a lot of the friends that I have in recovery are completely anti-gambling and just think that the industry is all bad and want to ban everything. And then on the other side, there's the industry that think that everything's okay as long as it's legal. And I think there just needs to be a bit of a sense. So, for example, when I work at a darts event and it's got perhaps the brand of the sponsorship on the stage and around the arena, that's not really luring me in personally to want to go and place a bet. That doesn't give me the sort of chills that perhaps Ray Winston tapping on my TV screen, flashing up odds, or slogans like it matters more when there's money on it. And I think just as a society and the gambling industry could just exercise a little bit more social responsibility in the more subtle way of encouraging responsible gambling. And again, from the side of us that have sort of got a story to tell, accept that, yes, it's a problem for some people, in fact, quite a lot of people, but we shouldn't really spoil that for everyone else by trying to ban everything. I don't think that's the route it should go down either.
Well, for example, you know, as you say, and your story, I'm sure, will be very familiar, you know, first started to understand betting or get into gambling at the age of 16, 17, playing football with older lads. Going to the football or going to the racing, I mean, you know, that's obviously a whole different industry and one that relies even more on gambling, but it's an inextricable and intrinsic part of the day. It's part of the routine. You go to the pub, you go to the bookies, then you go to the football. And in some football grounds, actually in most football grounds, there's a bookies in the concourse. Do you think that's right, that it can be made as easy as possible for anyone to come out and you know, make gambling part of their day?
I think you've certainly hit on the point that it is normalised totally in society, and not just in sport, actually, but if you ever have the pleasure of watching daytime TV, many of the programs are sponsored by, say, online bingo companies and things like that.
Yeah.
The National Lottery, obviously, is something that's become a big part of our culture and any sort of thing like that. So I think not just in sport, but yeah, I do certainly identify with the way that it is so normalized, especially to younger people. And I think that's where, as a society, perhaps we need to do a little bit more work. I gave a talk to a school last year, year 9 and 10 students, and they were telling me about the gaming industry, games like FIFA and other things that they play on, where actually they sort of have this kind of lottery of game packs where they can sort of get a lucky dip by paying money for a certain player or something if it's FIFA, and it might be then a disappointment that they might not get the standard of play that they want, which will encourage them to spend more money. So you're sort of getting gambling into the child's psyche at a very young age, and I think then as you grow up it is completely normalised. And for me, I think we need to do something as a society. Obviously the gambling industry would need to be involved with that as well. It's just to sort of make it clear that gambling is a choice and not something that you have to do if you're going to be involved in sport and things like that.
Well, I suppose it's an interesting point you make, and I hadn't thought of it before, but if you take, let's take Candy Crush, because it's probably the most universally successful, you know, gaming app over the last 10 years. If you do badly at that, you can pay to do better at it, you know, and that, I suppose, is a form of gambling, because you pay to have another life or get more diamonds or whatever, and that enables you to do it. I hadn't even thought of it like that, but it's the same sort of weapon, isn't it? The reason we're talking about this is because of this Paul Scholes story, and I wonder if you think, when you see a footballer like that, 140 bets over the space of 4 years doesn't sound like an awful lot, but when you've got someone in a position of responsibility, you know, he's a co-owner of a football club, he's been a football manager, do you think that is a good illustration of the fact that almost everyone in sport is gambling one way or another?
Yeah, possibly. I think the Paul Scholes thing, obviously it's a thing that's in the press at the moment, but I think it's actually almost quite a weak example. My sort of interpretation of that is that he's being a little bit silly looking at the figures and the number of bets. It doesn't look like he's got much of a problem.
Yeah.
However, I think it is, again, I think it is looking at the bigger picture, treating addiction as a problem, and just the normalisation of gambling as a problem. Because there is something in our society that says that every experience that we have needs to be somehow enhanced. We need to somehow enhance the excitement levels by drinking or gambling or doing whatever it is, and the social media and the games that you've just pointed out are certainly buying to that. But yeah, on Paul Scholes, it just seems to me that he's been a little bit foolish.
Just finally, Chris, if you were in charge tomorrow, if you were given the, you know, the Prime Minister's job, given that it's up for grabs at the moment, no one seems to particularly fancy it, what would be the one big change you think you could make to the way sport and gambling have a relationship that would make a real difference?
I just think just exercising a little bit more social responsibility. So I think that, like I said, just having the sponsorship isn't really luring people in. But I think, for example, at halftime in a football match, when they're saying, if you put £10 on this at 7-1, you're going to win £80, is a little bit, you know, that's trying to lure people in, when it, in fact, the likelihood is if you put £10 on this, you will lose £10. And I think maybe taking that kind of thing away, or pointing out the choice rather than saying you will win, would be a bit more of a responsible way to advertise in sport.
Chris, thank you so much for coming on. Fascinating to hear your story and someone who's been through the mill, and well done with your recovery. And I know that you're never recovered as an addict. You're always recovering. So congratulations and good luck with that as well. Chris Murphy there is a darts commentator with the PDC and also a recovering gambling addict.
Love sport.
Yes, Scotland crashed out of the Women's World Cup last night. They were 3-0 up against Argentina and it all looked fine with 20 minutes to go. Then conceded twice. And in injury time, there was drama. VAR and then VAR again. Lee Alexander thought she'd saved a stoppage time penalty, only to see the video assistant referee claim that she had come off the line early and force a retake. It's not even the first time we've seen this infringement pulled up by VAR in this tournament. And I imagine it left goalkeepers all over the world, including my next guest, absolutely fuming. Jimmy Walker, former goalkeeper for the likes of West Ham, spent time at Tottenham, Warsaw and Peterborough United as well, is on the line. Jimmy, I imagine that left you a little annoyed.
Well, it's going to be carnage, basically. Isn't it? I was just saying before, you know, we're going to have a real look at the rules again, because I don't think anyone's quite sure of what's happening as it stands at the moment. I mean, the odds are stacked for the outfield player taking the penalty anyway.
Yeah.
So to say the goalkeeper's got to have a back foot on the line, he's got no forward movement to make the dive, I think you'd have to sort of, well, look at it, if you were rewriting history with that rule, every goalkeeper would have been sent off or booked at least, and the penalty retaken from any save made. I can't remember any that has a back foot on the line sort of thing. You have to thrust your body weight forward to make the save. It's impossible not to.
Presumably you get taught to do that, don't you? That's part of how you learn to save penalties better.
It's just basic it's just basic.
It's physics, Jimmy. It's just physics.
It's just physiological. I ain't even saying them words. I think you're there. But you can't. It's impossible to dive from a standing position.
Yeah.
You're going to have to change it. And, like, my problem is going to be with, I mean, I have to look at the rules again from scratch and proper have a look, because it's going to be, I can see, like, while it gets going, there's going to be no saves. I mean, the quality of the players nowadays, especially at the higher level, I mean, they don't miss many penalties anyway now. If you look at it, the younger generation's grown up with penalty shootouts. They handle the pressure a lot more. They've possibly got a lot more technique on penalties because they practice them more. If you look at the last ones against Switzerland for England, for example, I mean, it was taking some saving anyway, and that's with moving.
Yeah.
So he could end up 20-all in some shootouts with a couple of bookings and maybe a sending off for the goalkeepers.
Do you think you'll get to the point? I mean, I know you work now, I believe, at Ipswich Town as a goalkeeping coach. You'll get to the point where you're teaching keepers to maybe start behind the line and push forward so they hit the line and dive from there?
But you know what? I think in that, and that is going to be after something you look at, sort of thing, or, you know, start behind, move across it, and then move into line behind. But players are that clever nowadays as well. I mean, most of them watch where the goal is going anyway, with their mind on, right, if he doesn't move, I'm going to put it in the bottom corner there. If he moves there early, I'm just going to go the other way. So the quality of the players now, if a goalie goes that early and runs into the save from behind the line, they're just going to wait, have a stutter and put it in the other corner.
Yeah.
I can't see any saves being made.
No. Well, it's an out. Look, I'm a goalkeeper as well, Jimmy. It's an outfielder's game. They don't like us. They don't want goalkeepers to have a good time.
Well, listen, you know, everyone, and this, I learned this in coaching over the years, everyone's a goalie hater. From managers to everyone's a goalie hater. And if we think along them lines, we've got a chance. We don't get too offended. That's why you have to have thick skin.
Yeah, indeed. Have you? I don't know how much of the Women's World Cup you've seen, Jimmy, but I feel like the goalkeeping standard in this Women's World Cup's been really pretty high. Even watching the Japan England game last night, there are a couple of cracking saves just in the first 20 minutes.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, they're getting better and better. To be fair, I mean, listen, you always get some mistakes that you think with any type of football.
Yeah.
Men or women's, or you know, non-league, in the first, second division, championship.
Yeah.
There's always going to be some mistakes. So yeah, you always get that. But I think on the whole, when I've watched it, I've been really impressed with it. And it's definitely like the women's football, it's going in the right direction.
Yeah.
Some of the quality on the show is excellent. So to have. For everyone to be talking about VAR again, it's a shame really for me, because I'd like to be talking about the quality. I mean, you watched the lady last night made the save out of the top corner.
Karen Bardsley, yeah.
She made a fantastic save. I mean, you know, that is out the top corner and out the top draw, really.
Yeah.
So, and the Japanese keeper made some great saves as well, you know. So the quality is there, and you know, it's just a shame we're talking about this. I mean...
Yeah,
I don't see where we go in the new season with these rules. Being honest, it's going to be carnage. It's not like we're just going to drip feed VAR in and get used to it. I'm of the ilk a little bit that I'm not adverse to VAR. To be honest, I think for factual decisions alone, and where the ref can go look at the watch and go, yeah, there's nothing wrong with that goal. The ball's over the line, it was offside, it wasn't offside, and it's a split decision thing, or within a few seconds, that's fine. But when they're going off the pitch and looking at TV screens, and they're still none the wiser whether it was a penalty or it wasn't a penalty, or it was a foul, it wasn't a foul.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'd rather actually, and I think plenty of people have seen it now, would rather the mistakes at times. Listen, don't get me wrong, it is an absolute glaring mistake by the ref, which you do get from time to time, because they've got a tough job. At times I've been the worst to criticise referees, but they've got such a hard job.
Yeah.
VAR's meant to help them, not actually make them worse.
yeah, and it does seem to make the decisions harder, because you start looking at every tiny element of it. Jimmy, while I've got you here, I must ask you, because you obviously spent some time at West Ham. Actually, I was going to say, I seem to remember you saving a penalty from Frank Lampard when you were at West Ham. Were you off the line? Should we have had that one ruled out?
Listen, if you went back on that, I was about on the 6-yard line saving that, I'll be honest. So that would have ruined me, because then I would have had to buy drinks in Essex for the last 12 years.
Very good.
Andy Durso got into a lot of trouble even then for letting me off, because I was about on the 6-yard line when it happened. But after 5 minutes of Lampard stepping up to take the penalty, and about 10,000 West Ham fans came out behind, there was no way he was.
No way he was going to disallow the save, certainly not.
I don't think he could have done it.
What do you make of West Ham at the moment? It sounds like there's a lot of players who, a lot of the big clubs are circling around. I know United are trying to do a deal for Issa Diop. I mean, they've got to fight hard to hang on to a player like him, haven't they?
Yeah, I think it's a massive time for West Ham now. You know, they're sort of at that crossroads at the minute. You know, with the new stadium, I think everyone's sort of getting back on board a little bit, you know. If the fans see improvement on the pitch and the signings of the and keeping players like the, you know, for 70 million and things like that off and batting those off, then I think the fans will take to the new stadium even more, because that's what it was there for, basically, to take them. I mean, I loved Upton Park along with everyone else that went. It was a fantastic atmosphere, but it had a ceiling, you know. With the new stadium, it was sold to the fans and, you know, new players as, you know, this could take us to the Champions League, basically. And the facilities are unbelievable. So if they can bat these offers off and go and buy people like, you know, your Paul Nels and people like they've bought in, well, then the fans will definitely buy on board. And I can only see, you know, a bright future for West Ham if they can sort of bat them offers off.
Do you think that bright future in the long term includes Declan Rice, or has he just got too much talent and he's inevitably going to end up at the likes of a Man City or a Man United?
No, this is what I'm saying. He has to stay for... I mean, he's done unbelievably. What a player as well. And he's West Ham through and through. You know, and he's been excellent. And fans, can connect with him so well there. So it's great to have someone like him playing alongside Mark Noble, you know, come through the same sort of ilk as that. Can only help him. But I think it's massive, massive for the club at the minute that they keep these players. They have to keep the players
and
back the offers off. And then on the back of it, talk to the players, say, listen, this is, we're not just keeping you for the sake of it. We want to kick on. We're going to buy these players that, you know, everyone's talking about. We want to be in the market for 50, 60 million plus players in the next couple of years. We want to push for the Champions League spots. The facilities and the whole reason they went to the new place was to do that.
Yeah.
Could have stayed at Upton Park and sold people and then brought new people through, and everyone would have kept a great atmosphere, and it would have been a club that, you know, they might do well in the top half of Prem one year, might struggle the next year. And it would have always been like that. But the new club was, the new stadium was under the promise that, listen, we're going to go for it, and we want to push them up the echelons of the Premier League.
Exciting times. Jimmy, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you're a busy man, but always a real pleasure to talk to a fellow goalkeeper as well. And it's true, everyone's a goalkeeper hater, whether they hide it or not.
Love Sport.
The Jeff Wyler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Wyler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Last night was a 2-0 win for England. England's women beat Japan to top the group. Phil Neville made 8 changes to the side, but that was not what he suggested he would do before the match.
We've got to pick our best side because we want to finish top of the group, and we want to continue and build the momentum that we've built in the first 2 games. So I'll be picking my best side to win the game tomorrow night.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there is something to be said, actually, that this England squad is so deep that there isn't necessarily an obvious best 11. I don't think Neville knows his best 11 either. I've often thought that watching England women over the last 6 or 8 months that I don't know what their best 11 is, and neither does he. But they play well. First half in particular, I thought they passed the ball really well. The addition of Tony Duggan, while she clearly wasn't fully fit and she wasn't as sharp as she can be, remember she missed the first 2 games through injury, a thigh injury, the Barcelona winger added something, absolutely added something. There was an early moment when England knocked the ball through midfield, Georgia Stanway's involved, Ellen White was involved early in the move. They got it to Duggan out wide on the right and she cut inside her marker like that. It was so easy, and I think it gave England some confidence. They've needed that confidence as well. They've often looked pretty just stuttering, I suppose is the word. I just haven't been that impressed by the way they've approached games, and I thought last night we saw a bit of that. It means they go through as group winners. They will play on June the 23rd, that's this coming Sunday. We don't yet know their opponent. It's going to be a third place team from either Group B, Group E, or Group F. So it could be China, and then anyone, frankly, of Cameroon, New Zealand, Chile, or Thailand. I would say they'll try to avoid Chile, because while they have lost twice, I think they've looked pretty good. The Chile goalkeeper in particular has played very well. They're likely to beat Thailand on the tonight as well, which would put them through as a third-place team and a potential team to play England in the last 16. However, England are in what some people might say is the wrong half of the draw. They are in with France and the USA, one of whom could be their semi-final opponent. But equally, Japan are probably going to play the Netherlands. And in the last 16, by the way, not even in the semi-final. A lot of people have been tipping the Netherlands as the dark horses in this tournament. I think they're the best team in the bottom half of the group. Bottom half of the draw, I should say. So I think England have done the right thing. I advocated Southgate losing their last group game last summer when England had a similar situation. But this England women's side are right up there, I think. We had Anne-Marie Batson, women's football writer, on the Comedy Breakfast show this morning, and she thinks England can compete with the top sides.
I think that's the general consensus this morning, that England definitely played with a lot more intensity than their other 2 games previously. They did tail off a lot in the second half, but they managed to pull it back for that second goal, and I think they're now starting to show why they are desperately wanting to be a part of that elite crew, if you like, of the USA's and the France. I think for the last couple of games there were a couple of question marks about whether England would be able to face a team like USA, and I think last night they were able to demonstrate they can do that. I mean, Japan definitely stepped it up in that second half, and our defence, particularly Steph Houghton and Millie Bright, the back two, they were really, really tested hard. But, you know, England managed to get it through. They get it done over the line. It means, as you rightly said, they've won three games out of three, and I think that's the best result in terms of group games since 1982 at a World Cup.
Yeah, quite the record that for England, never having done that since 1982. But they did play well. I thought Nikita Paris looked good when she came on off the bench as well. Karen Carney added something. Ellen White got two goals. She was lively. She didn't get a lot of service in the second half, but when she did, she took advantage. I think the worry for England will be that Sugasawa, who came off the bench, the Japanese number nine, who's dropped for the game, actually, but arrived as a substitute, she had two or three really gilt-edged chances. Now, there was one, and I mean this, absolutely world-class tackle from Steph Houghton. Now, that shouldn't be a surprise these days, because she's that good a player, and she's played at the highest level in England for so long. But it was a goal. Sugasawa was through, Houghton was nowhere, and I thought, well, this is it. And Houghton made a tackle that was, it was that sort of Bobby Moore-esque tackle where she threw herself across the turf, blocked the shot, took the ball, and then got up and carried it out as well. And I thought her and Millie Bright did the last ditch stuff, the physical defending, really well. But what would concern me is the fact that Sugasawa got in behind a couple of times. They're going to have to work on that for the later rounds because better strikers will put them to the sword.
Love sports.
We're going to speak to Gab Sutton, who's on the line, owner of the Football Lab and a Football League writer, because the Football League fixtures have come out for the season. Of course, they will all get moved for TV a tremendous amount. QPR are off to Stoke on the opening day. Millwall off to Preston. Oh, sorry, Millwall at home to Preston, I should say. Gab, Charlton's return to the Championship sees then head to Blackburn. Feels like a winnable game first up.
Potentially, yeah. I mean, I think with Charlton, there's a lot of sort of instability there. I mean, obviously, clearly the relationship between Roland Dutchesclet and Lee Bowyer isn't very strong. Otherwise, his contract situation would have been sorted out a long time ago. And I think it's only because of pressure that Dutchesclet has done a U-turn on this decision and given Bowyer the deal that he deserves for guiding Charlton to promotion. A lot of uncertainty there. I also think that in terms of recruitment, they're a little bit far behind. I think, not many teams have made additions yet, but in terms of the size of their squad, they are looking light. So I think although on paper, yes, Blackburn, you'd imagine will be sort of around the bottom half next season, I don't think that there's... I think it's going to, most games they'll play next season will be difficult.
Similarly, I mean, I look at Millwall and think that next season might be pretty tough for them, that they start the season at home to Preston North End. On the whole, how do you think they will shape up?
Well, I think it's going to be important for Neil Harris to freshen up the team. I don't think that he can rely so much on the players that guided them to eighth the season before last. And I think that he was actually quite scathing of the culture at Millwall in terms of the players after the last home game, when before that he'd kind of kept his powder dry. So it's going to be interesting to see. I think there's only about four players released by Millwall. So actually, a lot of the players that he might have criticised, he'll probably need to use because he's not going to be able to bring in all the players that he wants. So similar category to Charlton, I would imagine Millwall could be in for a tricky season.
Let's make it a hat-trick, because probably the one of the London clubs I think might struggle the most next season is QPR. If their budget cuts are as serious and swinging as we believe they are, as much as 65% of their wage bill might go this summer, how do you think they're going to deal with that? It's very hard to see how they might be able to overcome it.
Well, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because I think when there's been budget cuts in the Championship before, the approach has been to go for quite a short-term method, which is keep it tight, go for experienced players, sort of hold things together. More and more, what we're actually seeing in the Championship is more clubs actually going the other way and thinking, can we develop players that we can sell on in the next 12 months with a high sell-on value? And then you've got to play a certain style of football to actually develop those players in a way that will catch the eye of bigger clubs. I think Mark Warburton is probably the right man for that kind of transformation. I think he gives his players a lot of creative freedom, but he has got a difficult job on his hands, no doubt about that.
I have to ask you, Gab, as well, about Gary Monk. Actually, in the last, literally the last couple of minutes, a statement has come out through the LMA from Gary Monk. It's as gracious as actually you might expect, having dealt with Gary a little bit, sort of refusing to engage. He says, mindful of my contractual obligations, it is not my intention, certainly not at this stage, to engage with those comments the club has made in the wake of my dismissal. He calls them disappointing comments. He'd rather focus on the positives I've experienced in my time with Birmingham City. How would you assess his time at Birmingham City?
I think he's done a fantastic job, really. I think the only players he's been able to sign on permanent deals have been Christian Pedersen, who had a good debut season last year, and Kerim Mirabti, who's maybe taken a little bit of time to settle in from coming in from abroad. In terms of the budget he's been able to work with, and obviously the transfer embargo, I think he's been very pragmatic about the squad that he's been working with. I think he's developed a style of play that might not always be the most exciting on the eye, but I also think that Blues have been a threat in transition, especially after turning the ball in the opposing half. And he's got the best out of players like Lukas Djukovic, who you wouldn't necessarily have said before he came in he'd be one of the better strikers in the Championship. So, hugely impressive job. It didn't seem as though Monk wanted to fit into the structure at the club, perhaps in terms of having a director of football and a head coach. I think he maybe wanted a tiny bit more control, but I don't really have much faith in the current setup at Birmingham City to actually impose the structure in the right way. So I think it's a big mistake from Xuan Dongrang to have that bad relationship with Gary Monk. He saved his bacon, let's be honest about that. And then to dismiss him as manager.
Do you think, I mean, I would have thought after everything that Gary's done in his career, he'll be in quick demand. Are there any jobs that you think he might have his eye on?
Possibly, yeah. I think Derby County. Obviously, we don't know how the Frank Lampard situation will play
out. I think we know how that'll play out, Gab. Let's not be coy about it. He's going to Chelsea. It's a matter of when, not if.
Okay, yeah. If that does happen, then I would imagine that Gary Monk is a name that could appeal to the Derby County board. Obviously, Hull are without a manager at the moment as well, but I mean, after working with the board at Birmingham, you'd think he'd want more of a steady ship to work under.
Well, I mean, Derby's famously not a steady ship, but at least in the last year there have been, so maybe that'll fit him. Gab, thanks very much for joining us, as always, a real pleasure. Gab Sutton there, owner of the Football Lab. Yeah, that statement, by the way, from Gary Monk, just come out in the last couple of minutes. I've been trying to digest it while also talking to Gab there. Right from the moment I walked through the door, Monk says, I felt such a strong connection and understanding with the players, first team staff and our exceptional fan base. He talks a lot about the blue noses, the fans, but he says that our well-documented club issues brought massive difficulties before we'd even got started. And although the challenges continued throughout, my staff, players and myself were all determined to remain focused. They wanted to deliver an improved, competitive team with a clear identity, a side that represented values that are so dear to the fans. He says he's disappointed not to be given the opportunity to build on those solid foundations. However, I come away with a great sense of satisfaction and pride at the work we've done up until this point. Birmingham finished mid-table this year with a 9-point deduction, with almost no money and no discernible, and he says this, identity. He wanted a clear identity. He didn't really have one before Monk turned up. I think he's been extremely unlucky to lose his job there, although frankly, he might have got away with one, because if he doesn't like working within that setup, if he doesn't like the chairman, it doesn't work for him, why bother staying? He'll get plenty of other jobs elsewhere.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. Remember to leave us a rating and a review, but only nice ones. I don't take criticism well.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You hear that? That's the sound of Pepsi Zero Sugar, the better tasting, more refreshing Zero Sugar Cola. Listen to that endless pour. Pure refreshment. If it sounds this good, just imagine how it tastes. Oh yeah, so good. Pepsi Zero Sugar. Let your taste decide.